Okay, Mr. Fumby.
May it please the court. We're here today, I'm here proudly representing Janice Barnes, the mother of Ashton Barnes, who was killed at the hands of Officer Felix in April 2016. The issues here today, fundamentally, they all come down to whether there was a constitutional injury to Mr. Barnes on that day. And the trial court respectfully erred in their opinion that there was no constitutional injury for two fundamental reasons. Number one, the trial court improperly measured the moment in time at the wrong time of when Officer Felix perceived a threat in the case. The trial court found that the moment that the officer pulled the trigger was the proper moment of time to measure whether or not there was a sufficient threat. When in reality, the Officer Felix testified that upon pulling his weapon, my actions were to draw my weapon because I had already had the perception of him trying to flee. Officer Felix perceived that he was trying to flee before he ever jumped onto the vehicle, before he ever was in that situation, and Officer Felix made the decision.
Can I ask you a question about this particular arresting officer? He was a member of the Harris County Police Force.
The constable's office, yes.
Yeah, he was a trained law enforcement officer.
Correct.
And what was his relationship to the toll authority?
The Harris County basically owns the toll authority, and they own the road. So they basically hire the Harris County constable's office to patrol the roads. So they're specifically delegating the authority to patrol the roads to the constable's office. It's different and unique from other
people that don't pay for the toll tag.
Correct. It can fall into other categories, but their essential purpose is to make sure that the tolls are paid and that people are on the road.
What's the consequence of not paying for the toll tag?
Well, there's different consequences.
Other than what happened here.
I mean, generally speaking, there's a civil violation. So you can get sued by the county. There's a certain point in which you are can be deemed to be banned from the roads. And in this particular case, this was a rental car. So Barnes wasn't even the one that was responsible for any of this.
Was a police officer here that this person being arrested escaped, so to speak, the consequence would be that the toll tag the law would not be enforced. That is, he would have to pay for the tag or whatever.
Well, I don't think that would be the case because
the breach of law here is what I'm pushing is for failure to have a current tag, toll tag.
Correct.
Okay. Was he charged to wreck speeders too as well?
He was not speeding. He was not driving erratically.
I know his general charge was he got a specific call on this in this case that to look for this particular individual. Correct.
Correct.
Okay. He spotted that individual.
Well, I would change that slightly because it wasn't for him to look for this individual. It was for this specific vehicle. Because if you drive on that particular, and I understand if you don't live in Houston.
It was the vehicle he was looking for.
The roads in Houston and the toll roads have cameras. So when the second that you drive onto the toll road, they take a picture of the license plate, and there's pictures when you leave the road. So there's all these cameras and ability to track the vehicle. So the second that you drive onto the road and you pass under one of these cameras, there's a notification to the Harris County of who's driving on the road that particular day.
But this isn't just the normal toll enforcement. I mean, because you get that in the mail. This particular vehicle was not supposed to be on there. It wasn't just that it didn't have a proper tag or something. That those things get taken care of in the mail. They have a whole system of that. So this is not just somebody monitoring. This is monitoring for this particular vehicle for some reason that it's been that this vehicle cannot be on the toll road. This is not just because its tag is expired or something. This is, but even if it were, I don't know that what the relevance is, but just to be clear, that's not, the constables are not doing most of the tag maintenance thing because that's all done electronically, isn't it?
I mean, they're there to, I mean, their own statements are that they're there to enforce the tolls. So if they're not there, anyone's driving on the roads and they're not being able to pull people over, then anyone's just going to go and drive on the toll road. That's not really, their purpose there is to make sure that they have the presence on the road, both in terms of toll road enforcement, making sure that people like this, that they're driving vehicles that are prohibited or not driving on the vehicle, and to, and for the purposes of traffic enforcement and everything else. But they're specifically delegated the duty by the county to enforce the laws on this particular road, as opposed to other police forces or other areas of the county where they don't have that duty delegated by the county. It's just delegated by the general authority.
You're not questioning the legitimacy of the stop, right?
No, I'm not. I think, I mean, there's nothing, there's no problem with him being pulled over. It's just whatever happened once he was pulled over, that's the issue.
So when do you believe the unconstitutional, I mean, is it when the trigger was pulled, or are you saying that he shouldn't have had the gun? It seems like you're saying that he had the gun pulled too soon or something.
Well, I think if you look, and it's hard because if you watch the video, it happens very quickly, and it's hard to tell exactly what happens. But we go through the deposition testimony, and we go through with Officer Felix what he perceived at any given point of the encounter. And Officer Felix opens the door. He's standing in front of Mr. Barnes, and he perceives that Mr. Barnes is going to flee. Before he steps on the vehicle, he perceives that he's going to flee. And Officer Felix stated at that point, when he drew his weapon, he thought his life was in danger. So he perceived that the threat was at that point when he was standing on the side of the vehicle, when he perceived that Ashton was going to flee. And after that point, that's when you start the clock in terms of the moment in time, because he decides, he knows his car is fleeing. He decides to jump onto a fleeing vehicle where the only possible outcomes are bad. This is actually, there could have been a lot of scenarios that were far worse. Shooting at the driver of a moving vehicle on a busy toll road could have ended up killing other people, very likely could have ended up killing the officer.
Are you arguing some kind of state-created danger theory here? I don't quite understand. I mean, once the officer was on the running board and the vehicle was moving, the officer had a legitimate reason to think that he, the officer, was in danger. Can we agree on that?
I can agree. At that point in time, there was a danger. But my issue is that you can't simply say, well, any point in time, if the officer perceives danger, then it doesn't matter what the officer did or what happened before that. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Well, if he was in danger at the time that the vehicle was moving, which I think I heard you just agree to, then I don't know what difference it makes what would have happened beforehand.
I think the problem is the moment that he jumps on the car, the outcome is inevitable. There's no other outcome that could have been different. So when you have the threat where he perceives his life as in danger is before he jumps on the car. And once he jumps on the car, there's no good outcome. This is not a situation.
There's a good outcome. The driver sees that there's an officer hanging on to his car, so the driver thinks, hey, I've made a big boo-boo here. I'm going to stop. And he stops. That's not a bad outcome. That's a perfectly good outcome.
That could be a good outcome, except for the fact that the officer, within seconds of jumping on a vehicle, shot the driver. And under Harris County's own expert's testimony, it takes 6 to 7 seconds for an individual to even be able to perceive or make a decision based on stimuli. So Ashton didn't even have the ability to make the decision to stop the vehicle until he had already been shot, at which point he did actually stop the vehicle. So we can't even tell what Ashton would have done if he had waited a few more seconds or had the ability to stop the vehicle. Because the officer fired so quickly, so rapidly after he jumped on the vehicle, Ashton had no choice in what he was going to do, because at that point, the decision had already been made by Officer Felix. And really—
But like the gun was already pulled while he's standing there beside the car.
Correct.
And so he made a choice, though, when he hit accelerator, right? He did have a choice.
Well, he did have a choice to flee,
It's a terrible, sad thing. I'm not belittling that in any way, but he had a choice not to hit the accelerator.
Well, I understand that, but constitutionally, the decision to flee is not sufficient for the officer to use deadly force.
You're making a Garner argument that I don't understand it, that the officer cannot take the life of another, a fleeing felon, a felon or whatever else, period.
Yes, exactly.
Your argument earlier about, well, he shouldn't jump on there because then it might lead to this and that could cause innocent people to get hurt in addition to people who are doing minor things. Isn't that precluded by the Mullenix case, the idea that things that might be perceived as what the officers do might be dangerous? You know, that, I mean, many of us, I think, agreed with that proposition, but the Supreme Court specifically said no.
I think there's different scenarios. There's the scenarios where the officer created a risky situation that later led to intervening actions by the driver or someone else. And then you have the scenario where the officer directly created the danger that caused the threat. Here we have one very short incident where the officer made this decision. There was no opportunity for Ashton to make an alternative scenario. It would be one thing if the officer had jumped on the vehicle and the car was driving down the road for 30 seconds and it was clear that Ashton had the chance to stop and he didn't. But Ashton had made the decision to flee. That decision was constitutionally acceptable for him to not be killed by the officer. He didn't have the opportunity to make any other decision. And if the officer had not jumped on the vehicle, it is undisputed that Ashton Barnes would not be here today, or he would be here today, living and breathing in front of us, because he would not have been killed by Mr. Felix. The decision—
Was he in danger from being hit anyway?
In what way?
Was he not in danger of being hit with the back of the car and the door?
No, because the police vehicle was parked immediately behind him. He's standing behind the vehicle. The only direction to go is forward at the end of the day. That argument was never even brought before the trial court. So, but he was, the danger is very slight at the end of the day of him being in danger. And he didn't even perceive that. When you go through his testimony, he never thought that he was in danger of being run over backwards. The only danger was once he already jumped on the vehicle, once he already committed to doing this action, that's when he was in this danger. But by that point, it was already done. The decision.
So a reasonable officer would let him go at that point?
Correct. A reasonable officer would let him drive.
And you think our case in Harmon is not to the contrary?
Well, I think Harmon, in the holding of Harmon, specifically states in situations where the officer is an unwilling passenger of the vehicle. And Harmon and Davis v. Romer, both are similar cases. The officer was trapped on the vehicle either through the window going up and their arm was trapped, but they had made the decision to go on the vehicle before they knew the car was going to flee.
But
in this case—
Well, is that true? Because in Harmon, they abruptly rolled up the windows and reached for his keys. So he thought they were going to flee, probably. And then he jumped on. He's rolled the window, grabbed the keys. You don't grab the keys if you're not about to move.
Well, respectfully, the court is very clear. It's unwilling party, unwilling passenger to the vehicle. And he felt that those officers in that particular situation felt that they had no choice but to to stay on the vehicle because they were trapped on the vehicle.
No, he got on the vehicle after the person rolled up the windows and reached for the keys.
Yes.
So he chose to get on the vehicle at a pivotal moment, knowing that the guy is about to flee.
Because he had no other option.
Why did he have no other option in that case but had an option here? He got on the vehicle after the guy grabbed the keys.
Because in this particular case, in this particular case, Officer Felix perceived at the very outset the vehicle was going to flee. All he had to do was stand there.
And I shouldn't call him that guy, Mr. Harmon, is who I should have said. Go ahead.
My apologies.
No, that's my apologies.
And in this case, all Officer Felix had to do was just stand there and do nothing.
Well, that's the same thing as Mr. Harmon. I mean, and Mr. the city in that case. He could have just stood there while the guy rolled up his window, grabbed his keys, and he didn't have to jump. He jumped on the side knowing the guy is about to take off.
Well, I think it's because he felt like he had to do that because he was stuck on the vehicle. And so the situations...
How was he already stuck on the vehicle when he chose to get on the thing after the person grabbed his keys?
I mean, I think it's hard. You have to break down the facts of it.
Well, that's what we have to do to apply our precedents.
Exactly. But I mean, I think in this particular situation, he had the opportunity to just stand there and do nothing, and he chose not to. Thank you.
All right. You've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Fombe. Thank you. Mr. Budd?
Good morning, Jim Budd on behalf of Appalese. I would like to broaden the presentation of duties of the constable, Your Honor. This particular deputy was a traffic enforcement officer, handling accidents, handling speeding, and also handling prohibited vehicles. So this was a duly licensed by TCOL law enforcement officer with 12 years of experience, and he was enforcing the law, and that's what they do. And this court has recognized that as law enforcement officers, they make split-second decisions in situations that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving. Now, Mr. Barnes had some opportunities to make different decisions and to change the outcome of this case. He was asked for his driver's license and insurance. He didn't have it. First, he said he didn't have it, then he said it's in the trunk. And at a few seconds later, he began rummaging in the front of the vehicle, looking for something, I guess. He was actually looking at the constable when he was digging, and the constable directed him to stop digging. He told him that 4 times. Now, that is concerning. And so, a few seconds later, on the dash cam video, this constable says, "Please step outside." And that's a pivotal moment where either compliance or defiance is going to define the outcome of this case. And he chose defiance. He did not get out of the vehicle. Instead, he reached for his keys, he turned the vehicle back on, and the deputy was between a rock and a hard place at that point. Unaware whether or not Mr. Barnes would resort to deadly force. He had a weapon, a 9mm Taurus, in that vehicle. And also considering that this was on the left shoulder of the freeway or the tollway, 4 lanes of pretty high speed traffic going along, a very difficult decision. And unfortunately, the outcome was determined by Mr. Barnes. Now, this court, ever since Young versus City of Killeen in 1985, has held that the moment of threat is determinative. It is not what could be avoided or what could be exacerbated or what could be changed by any preceding conduct. It is the moment of threat. Young versus City of Killeen, Frere versus City of Arlington in 1992, and more recently, Roma versus Davis, Harmon versus City of Arlington, and in other contexts, Rockwell versus Brown, Harris versus Sherpas. All of these things tell us that the threat of harm predominates in analyzing whether force is reasonable.
What do you say to the argument that he didn't need to step onto the car at that point? He could have just said, see ya, and then everything would have had a different outcome.
Well, the officer has a duty to enforce the law, and that's a tactical decision. And it's not a constitutional violation to jump on the vehicle. It's a tactical
decision. Then at that point that he didn't have time to perceive the other person, that was almost inevitable is their argument at that point.
Well,
that he's going to get shot because the other person's not going to be able to stop the car and realize it in time.
That sounds to me as a avoidability argument rather than a moment of threat. In other words, the appellant is attempting to expand the moment of threat to a moment that is not a moment of threat. And the moment of threat comes after the deputy says, don't fucking move, don't fucking move. He says that twice before he fires the two rounds that ultimately kill Mr. Barnes. Now, there again, the defiance of Mr. Barnes is hard to explain, and it's regrettable and lamentable.
Let me ask you a question at that point, sir. Your argument doesn't really address the reality that another operative principle that it's long been settled that you cannot take the life of a fleeing felon or anybody else.
Yes.
Well, you have a lot of fact patterns in these cases.
Yes.
They're difficult because they create. And putting aside the question of who created the danger, what you have here is simply a traffic violation. And then at that point, what you say is that he had no real choice. His choice was to kill him. And but he did. He made that decision. But he's the flee. He's just fleeing. He had to make the. Why did he have to jump on the first? Once he jumped on the running board, there's no other way to stop him other than shoot him. And so I understand you. He gets away. Okay, but the baseline we start with Garner is you cannot take the life of another person unless there's a threat to your own life or to the life of another. And so I just wanted to give you a chance to
Yes, and that's the holding of Lytle versus Bexar County.
I'm sorry.
But this is different. This the deputy in this case is not four houses behind and is certainly in a position of relative safety. He is in the fray. And he is not shooting to kill anyone. He is shooting to stop the threat. And that may be the same outcome, but it's different. It's a different motivation. And he was given-
You use deadly force as the principle.
It's deadly force. That is correct, Your Honor.
That's the issue for me. Yeah. I understand the situation, and those are difficult.
Well, it is a split-second decision, just as Graham versus Connor sets forth, and this court has consistently set forth.
Well, let me take this hypothetical. He actually runs on his feet. He's out. He runs. And you've got to make a split-second decision. I'm going to stop the guy or not. That's why I stop him. I shoot him. It's a split-second decision. So the shortness of time is only one component of it. The question is whether or not he had a choice. The officer had a choice, and that.
Well, the prospects for the officer were.
I'm not suggesting one way or the other, but I think that's a tension point in the case.
The prospects for the officer were quite dire. Hold on and hope he stops, fall off and have a living example of the coefficient of friction in your life, or get run over in some other way by moving traffic. So it is not a safe situation for him.
They weren't on an open roadway, were they? I thought they were off the roadway.
This was on the shoulder of a very active four-lane, high-speed tollway.
Pictures. There was a rail on the left side of the car. That doesn't tell me that they were on the inside lane. Help me.
They were on the left shoulder of a four-lane road separated by a median, and that K-rail.
I thought he was protected from traffic on the left side because there was a barrier there.
That's only for the traffic in the other direction.
On the other side of the car.
Sure. This traffic is going southbound, and on the other side of the median, it's going northbound.
Okay.
If he'd have just stood there, though, he wouldn't get hit by any cars. It's the officer. I think this case may be similar to this other case, which is why I ask questions about it. I'm not predetermining it, but he wasn't in danger unless he got on the car at that point.
I would disagree with Your Honor.
Can you help me understand how he was?
Suppose the vehicle backed up. He would be in danger of
if the vehicle backed
movement.
Up.
And also, suppose the driver then reached down and drew a weapon. He would be in danger of that. So these are permutations that the officer must consider in a split second of time.
But whenever he was already driving forward.
Then it's his options are even more limited. Hoping that the vehicle will stop.
Well, no, he didn't have to get on the vehicle once it's already going. I think that's their argument is that because it was already starting, you shouldn't jump on a going vehicle because you're not going to get hit in the rear and you're not going to be shot if you're not jumping on the vehicle that's going forward.
But that misses the point that he has no cover. He is out there without any cover, and he is a sitting duck for whatever is going to happen.
So your position, as I understand it, is that for whatever reason, the officer got on the running board. Once he got on the running board of a moving vehicle, he, the officer, was in danger.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that distinguishes this case from possibly some other cases where the officer was not in danger. And in other words, you're saying it doesn't really matter why he got on the running board. I mean, he was legitimately trying to enforce the law or stop this driver. But for whatever reason, he was there, and once he was there, he was in danger, so that he was justified in taking action to protect himself. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I understand you to say that once he stepped on the running board, what followed was inevitable. Because
inevitability is quite a determinative conclusion. It depends on what Mr. Barnes does, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
It depends on what Mr. Barnes does, doesn't it?
The fleeing person, if he doesn't stop.
It is not like the devil made me do it. This is not the way it works. He has free will. He can make decisions on his own.
I felt uncomfortable to make a decision to run, and police officers can't shoot him just because he runs. We know that. Mm-hmm. And although he's free to make the decision to stop and be arrested, that has nothing, that doesn't control.
Well, he can run, but if he's imperiling the officer has a moment of threat and can resort to deadly force, because that is a predominant consideration.
As I looked at the pictures, why wasn't he free to step back? When he starts forward, he just steps down. It's going 2-3 miles an hour. The most that can happen, he'll stumble, but he's out of the car, and he's in there. Well, there's traffic out there.
Well, the speed of the car, it exceeds 2 or 3 miles an hour as it accelerates. And there again, that imperils the deputy.
It's been going far, but as I read the record, it stopped within 40 feet.
No, Your Honor, it was more like 100.
100 feet? 30 yards? Okay.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bell. Mr. Bumby for rebuttal.
I wanted to readdress the previous question about the Harmon case, and I think one of the main things here is just the evidence presented by Officer Felix himself in terms of his perceptions of what happened that day. He made it very clear that from the moment he walked up to the vehicle, even though he had nothing on Mr. Barnes, not even a name, that he thought he was up to something.
What's up?
Sorry about that. that he was up to something and that he needed to be stopped. His perception of him fleeing started well before the various moments before he decided to jump on the vehicle. He had more than enough time to think about what should I do if this particular person flees? What should I do if he drives off? And his decision, he even went through in his deposition of what he planned on doing if he did drive off was to somehow grab into the vehicle and put it into park. And in this really crazy plan of what he actually thought, this is his own testimony of what he thought he was gonna do when he decided to flee. So he had the time, the foresight to think about what was going on. This wasn't a momentary thing where he didn't know what to do and it made a mistake. Even looking backwards, he states that he would do it exactly the same way, even considering the outcome of the case. And ultimately, I think it's important that, you know, when we talk about the case law, my apologies. There hasn't been any precedent in terms of when the officer directly creates the threat in Fifth Circuit precedent. There's been cases where the officer was through some negligence, created a risky situation, but not something in this directly where he created the threat that caused the damage. And given the timetables of how quickly the officer acted, I think it was very likely that the outcome would occur. This wasn't something where the officer did something silly and then the driver had a chance to make a decision. The driver simply had no chance whatsoever. And on the issue of...
So what should the officer have done, given the situation as we know it?
At what particular point? From the point of when he receives...
Well, the driver is getting his keys, right?
Yes.
All right, and then what happened right after that?
If they see the driver getting his keys, he should just step away and walk away and reduce the potential danger to himself and to other drivers. In fact, I think even HPD, Houston Police Department, has made it a policy of not pursuing these types of individuals because it's so dangerous.
What do you do with the principle that's out there that it is no answer that the law officer created the danger?
What's that?
There's no answer that the law officer created the danger that required him to use excessive force. That the question still asks the question, the necessity of it.
Well, I think ultimately the Fifth Circuit hasn't really directly addressed that issue. There's other circuits, the Seventh Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, and other circuits have. And specifically, the example that I've seen is when an officer sees a vehicle driving on the road and then steps in front of the vehicle and uses that as a justification to shoot the driver of the vehicle, clearly everyone would say that he was not justified in that situation. If the officer is directly creating the threat as opposed to creating a risky situation, the precedent should not be that the officer can do anything, and it doesn't matter if he was at fault. It doesn't matter if he was responsible. Ultimately, you have to look at, what did Barnes do? Barnes did nothing but flee.
The lower court thought he was bound by that principle, that it is no answer that the officer created the duty, and that's what the lower court based on. My question is, what do we do with that principle? It's out there.
Well, I mean, I think you have to kind of grapple with this idea of, ultimately, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. You have to see, what did the parties do? You have to look and see, what did Barnes do? And then what did the officer do? Ultimately, Barnes did not.
Let me give you a quick example from an actual case itself. A man's walking, and he actually has a police officer himself, but he's in civilian clothes. And the police are called, the disturbance call, they arrive, and they report that he has a gun. Then a second officer shows up on the scene that has no background to it, and he comes in and with his police dog, and he puts a German Shepherd attack dog, gives him the attack dog to go at him, and the dog attacks him, and guess what? The man is a young man, and the young man lowers his hands, and so the guy shoots him. The outcome of that case was that there was no liability.
I believe the case found that the first five shots was not responsible, and the second two were because he was lying on the ground.
But I'm saying the fellow that came in it created the danger, to say the least. In other words, he said he lowered his hands, and that was a threat to him under the circumstances. But the man lowered his hands to fend off the attack dog.
I think there has to be some level of accountability for officers.
Well, I understand, but
of the case law has kind of changed in the last few years. From that case, 2016 until today, I believe the state of the law has been more broadened in terms of looking at. In terms of looking at the responsibility of the party.
If you've answered Judge Higginbotham's question, I have a question.
Sure.
Have you answered? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
You were mentioning the City of Houston's policy regarding not going for fleeing people. That is not part of this case, and both as a time matter and the fact that this is a county official, right? And do you recognize that creates an incentive for people will flee? And should the court be concerned about that?
I mean, I think, yes, I agree. It was not part of the record because, in fact, that happened, I think, as early as this year. So clearly it was not the case.
And it's the county, not the city, and so it wouldn't apply to a constable from Harris County anyway.
Correct. And my point there is merely that other police forces believe that the risk of pursuing these individuals is high. And I think the testimony from our expert is that the risk of pursuing these individuals is high because of all of the things that can happen in high-speed chases. And especially when you're talking about someone jumping on a vehicle, it's an extremely risky thing to do. And the chance of good outcome is low.
All right, thank you, Mr. Fomby. Your case and all of today's cases